This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 101, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Toby Taupitz, CEO of InsurTech Lacker. It's quite a curious process as to how folks come to be on the show. And I say curious with a sense of curious myself, as although you'd think by now that being in three figures, I might have some idea about what I'm doing, having chosen 100 guests. Indeed, some podcasters, including YouTube in this these days, have researchers to do this bit for them, just like the mainstream media. And of course, as a business model efficiency kind of thing, that makes a lot of sense. However, I don't do that, as efficiency doesn't mean quality. A large part of the LFP is finding the quality ingredients in the first place, especially the lesser-known quality ingredients, whether one is talking about the most downloaded firm in the podcast these days, LMAX Exchange, or a relative startup like Lacker. In the case of Lacker, I was speaking to someone who really knows the insurtech world inside out, and they came recommended to me. He spoke highly of a whole bunch of insurtechs and said, "But if I was being really tough and really honest, I'd say there's only one that's actually doing something radically different," which of course piqued my interest and hopefully yours. My chum had also put his money where his mouth was and was an investor. So what is this insurtech that an industry insider tells me is so unique? Let's read some words I found on Crunchbase. "At Lacker, we want you to understand what you're buying. We designed our policies so simple and short you can actually read it." Okay, that sounds good, if perhaps a little bit naive, as there are cost implications in this, no doubt. Mega insurers' profitability is in part derived from having this contractual complexity and wiggle room, at least in some types of insurance, although other types like life insurance, or actually death insurance as it is, have less wiggle room than most in arguing about whether it's triggered or not. Second point about Lacker, you pay a monthly fee, which is your share of all claims from people like you. No claims means your share is zero. I think this may be the really radical thing my chum was referring to, and brings us to the heart of this episode, true P2P insurance. As I read this, you pay nothing for your insurance in months where there are no claims, yet you were insured. And in another sentence, if it comes to a claim, there are no more surprises. We work with you towards a common goal, get back what has been lost and fix what has been broken. We only get paid when we deliver on this promise. No idea what that all means, no doubt we'll find out later. Anyway, true peer-to-peer insurance is the topic of the show today, which is novel. There have been attempts in the past, but a lot of them have founded for one reason or another. I guess one is who is in your pool. I wouldn't want to be pooled, for example, with a bunch of fraudulent claimers. So as always, a simple idea, but like a first move in a game of chess, it has many ramifications. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Toby. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So I was desperately trying to break the run of people I've had recently talking about their holidays and trying to get something more interesting than football or cars. And you were saying that by way of a hobby, you'd taken to beating up people recently.
That's right. It's not my team, though. I was set out to start doing Krav Maga, a self-defense, to blow some steam, a lot of fitness required, and then some techniques. So very good as a balance.
And Krav Maga is from Brazil or Philippines? I'm getting confused.
That is the Israeli one.
Israeli, that's right. Yeah, somewhere right between the two of them.
Exactly.
Yes, that's quite big in Russia as well. So how long have you been doing that one for?
Only started recently, roughly half a year ago, and doing it 2-3 times a week. It's very close to our offices, quite convenient, no excuses for me anymore.
And there's obviously an external martial art and obviously very focused on, should we say, combat efficiency.
It is. It's all geared towards self-defense, and it's really a feel-good factor, but also the physical fitness is very important.
And how do you actually, I mean, having done sort of more Chinese martial arts myself, how do you actually practice it? Because there are a number of these things. I mean, really back in the day, someone that worked for me in the back office did, I don't know, it was Aikido or something like that. Anyway, his main claim, he was a sort of short guy, not very strong, and his main claim was that, you know, he could kill someone with one blow. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't, but it's actually quite difficult to kind of test whether you can, because you've just killed your partner and that kind of stuff. And Japanese martial arts ends up going down some, I think, the sports route. You know, you've got karate where you're only allowed to do this, and you've got judo, you're only allowed to do that. And some of the Chinese martial arts go down almost like a dance route and this kind of thing. And the traditional Chinese martial arts go down pushing hands where you might stand on a platform, you know, and I'm not allowed to beat the crap out of you, but whoever falls off the platform first is lost. How do you actually test yourself when you're learning something which is very combat efficient without actually beating people up in Krav Maga?
So I guess the ambition and the aim is to get away from a dangerous situation with whatever means required and necessary. So that includes running away if the situation permits, but also giving you space to do so. The idea is to clear the situation without getting harmed. You can do a lot of sparring there. The techniques are quite important. And it's also quite good to have a game plan in your head. But obviously, that takes years of training, and I'm not there yet. But it's a very interesting journey.
I remember back in the day when I came to London and hadn't been in London very long, I did Tai Chi with a guy called Dan Doherty in Covent Garden. And Dan Doherty was a very hard man. The saying that you can take a man out of Glasgow, but you can't take Glasgow out of the man. And he'd been in the Hong Kong police force, as had a subsequent Chinese mastermind been in the Hong Kong police force. And certainly back in the day, the Hong Kong police force didn't mess around. They were the kind of people that knew what justice was, and they would dispense it quite often without, you know, bothering the courts. And they had to put up with a triad, so it was a really sort of tough world out there. And this guy was Southeast Asian martial arts champion in all weights. And the first year he was in it, he got through to the final, but he was so beaten up that basically he couldn't fight in the final. And the next year he won, having done a lot of Neigong, which we don't need to go into now what Neigong is. Anyway, I remember a young girl asking him what the best advice is if someone's hassling you. And he said, hit them in the balls and run away. You know, and that's a hard man coming back to this thing. And I heard a Navy SEAL recently on the New Man podcast. They'd been with his family and going to some supermarket in America. Some people started hassling them. You know, he could have killed all three of them. But, you know, he sort of said, no, sorry, guys, you know, whatever. You know, just drove off. And his wife starts giving him a hard time, saying, look, you're a bloody Navy SEAL. Why didn't you take them out? And he's pointing that it doesn't matter who you are, you're never 100.00%. You know, you can only be 99.9% maybe. Maybe all three of them had a gun. Maybe they shot the family. Maybe they stabbed your kids or something like that. So, yes, the running away is a very good piece of
advice. I guess it's exactly the point. You never know if the person is armed. So why get yourself in a dangerous situation if you can clear it perfect? And I think that's all about it. We are wearing groin guards, by the way. And even with the groin guards, it hurts if you get a knee there. And so without it, it must be even worse. So yes, it's a good advice. Kick him in the groin.
Talking about sort of the gentleman's area, the Tai Chi used to be next to the Taekwondo, this Korean one where we do lots of kicking and things. And it was mostly males. And quite a lot of them seemed to be sort of kicked in the sort of gentleman's area. And they used to be absolutely sort of wiped out on the floor. It looked terrible. And what they used to do, actually, they used to grab their feet and sort of pump their legs towards their chest or something. So useful consumer advice. Okay, so learning martial arts is obviously a vital form these days of insurantech, particularly if you've got fraudulent claims. So how did your career journey take you from where you were to where you are today?
Yeah, so I guess my dad is to blame for all of this. He's a broker home in Germany, so I spent some time during summers working with him. I went the typical way of German education, doing an apprenticeship, studying insurance business and actuarial sciences. Spent some time working for insurance companies and then ran away from it as fast as I could. I set out my career in corporate finance after having seen the world for a bit, studying in Singapore, in Dublin, for instance, working in Paris. And yeah, starting in corporate finance led me to see interesting worlds in financial services. And it was, in fact, at my last stop, an investment bank where I covered insurance and fintech at the same time, where these two worlds came together and an idea was formed in my head. Why is it done like that? Could it be not done differently? And that was the moment when previously Insure a Thing was born, a very stale old-fashioned name, which has now turned to Laka, a much more engaging name, I hope.
And Laka, you were saying, was a Hawaiian goddess, or is a Hawaiian goddess.
That's right. We need a short, crisp consumer brand, Laka, the Hawaiian goddess of prosperity and hula dancing. And that at least gives our customers a smile that didn't happen with Insure a Thing.
And talking of Asia, I was wondering what it was like studying in Singapore. I mean, I hear quite a lot to myself about what it's like studying with Chinese who come over to the West. I was talking about this the other day, actually, that someone that Chinese is a massive generalization for a whole bunch of populations who are all actually very, very different. It's like a sort of huge Han Empire. But talking about my Chinese master, he's relatively short, but his master was Manchu and is bigger and taller than me, a sort of huge bear of a man. And Singapore is a very different place from mainland China. And what I hear about sort of Chinese students who come over here is they spend most of their time in the library and work really hard and never ask questions and all this kind of stuff. But what was it like for you as a European studying in Singapore?
I had a quite similar picture. So it was highly competitive among locals, so to speak. We've seen people sleeping in the library to be the first one at the desks, which is horrible. I was rather lucky, I have to confess and admit. I was part of the MBA courses and we were much more westernized and had a different schedule, which was much more focused on projects with companies actually hands-on. and much less theoretical studying by heart. So I think we didn't have to compete directly with the bachelors, the undergrads in the programs. But yeah, I think the picture is confirmed, you mentioned.
Yes, actually, I mean, Singapore's been very advanced for a long time. I saw something recently about mainland China doing something like, I don't know, something crazy, like 30 times as much or 10 or 30 times as much e-commerce as exists in America and being technologically advanced. So all of that led to you can run, but you can't hide. So you ran away from insurance because of the family connection and there's no straight lines in a world of gravity. You get sort of sucked back round. So before we come on to Hawaiian goddesses and your current insurance, let's talk a little bit about this P2P insurance thing. We were talking beforehand that you listened to Steve Mendel, who I'm a big fan of, bought by many, who was on the show, whatever it was, about 2 or 3 years ago. And I was saying that actually he did such a good job at the time that it's kind of created a sort of a dead land, a dead zone for insurtechs coming on the show because it was really not very easy to go beyond what he've said. More recently, in the last year, insurance as a service and all this kind of stuff, we're seeing a new bunch of insurtechs arising who are revisiting some of those old assumptions. And so just going back to the sort of very basics, I think at the time there were some quotes P2Ps, insurtechs in Europe, but I remember Stephen saying there are less insurtechs than fingers on two hands. It was really quite small. So historically speaking, have there been many P2P insurtechs and have they been successful?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So we have seen P2P emerging as a phenomenon in the early 2010s, 11s, as a new form of offering, providing insurance. And I think at that time, very innovative. I think we have moved on quite a bit. The regulator is more engaged, is more open now. The insurers are opening up. I think most importantly, in contrast to your conversation you just mentioned now, insurtech has become a thing, which is important because it means resources are flowing in. That is money, that is talent, and that's really important to try out different things. So I think peer-to-peer was a great starting point. It raised awareness that there could be another world to do the business. And now interesting propositions emerge with different success, of course.
And you were saying that in terms of you guys, and going back to the surround, which as you say is changed a lot, it's a very supportive surround. You're mentioning the whole sort of bunch of entities that have been really valuable on your journey.
Absolutely. So I was very lucky that when I left my previous job at a bank that I was desperately looking for proof points for people to support me in a world where I had very little networks. So there is the Anthemis Fellowship program to start with that gives you a home to explore your ideas. There are accelerator programs like Startup Bootcamp InsurTech to help you get started. And very important for us was then the FCA Sandbox, an initiative to test new business models live in the UK market that helped us figure out the right regulatory framework. So the ecosystem is there, the support is there. I think if you look hard enough, you will get what you need.
Okay, so the world's moved on a little bit. InsurTech has been around. Let's deconstruct what we mean by peer-to-peer insurance. Peer-to-peer, there's this awful phrase, which I think it was right for Napster from a computer perspective and has been wrong for everything else, including peer-to-peer lending. I mean, peer-to-peer lending, someone puts money into the system and it goes out to somebody else, but we don't really mean that in peer-to-peer insurance, as I understand it. It's more kind of everybody puts some money in a pot. It's like going for a bunch of beers in the evening. As students, you might all put 10 quid in and the pot pays out everything. So what kind of peer-to-peer models exist in insurance? And what do we actually mean by P2P insurance?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in saying that in P2P insurance, it's different to the lending world. It is not one borrower and one lender. It's actually one group of people putting money in the same pot as mentioned. How I understand P2P insurance, and I think as it's commonly defined, it's a group of people with a common interest to insure and to look after. More often than not, you have an underlying insurance partner. Think of two buckets, for instance. Me as a person and my friends want to insure our cars. So we have £100 in premiums. Half of that goes in bucket one. That is actually going to the insurance company, as in the old world, to cover large losses, total loss, theft, for instance. The other part goes into a separate bucket where smaller claims are paid off the windshield, for instance, of one of my friends. If at the end of the year some money is left in bucket two, we will get some money back because we have less claims than anticipated.
So in terms of your buckets, would I be correct in saying that it's a bit like the joint bucket pays for the excess? Let's say, for the sake of example of cars, take a random figure. Let's say that half a dozen of you get together and you insure your cars for losses more than £1,000 with an insurer. As you say, like it gets written off or something like that. But you have a big excess and you use some of the money that would have gone on insuring the excess to put it into a pot, which you then share out amongst you.
There are all sorts of variations nowadays. There are even now cryptocurrency-based solutions that you allow and set the excess, for instance. There are different kinds of plays you can really tap and look into. I think most commonly it is that the bucket two pays for small claims with or without an excess, and only when the money is taken up, you will go to the insurer to ask for more to cover the whole car, so to speak.
I see. So in a sense, you're doing a number of things at the same time in this model. You're slicing off the low risks, and a group of you are effectively self-insuring, and the larger risks are insured in the conventional marketplace. So forgetting the phrase P2P altogether, if you couldn't use the word P2P, you would say we're pooling insurance, we're taking the low risks ourselves as a group, we're passing the larger risks on, which of course is remarkably similar to what insurers and reinsurers do. Insurers themselves pass the larger risks to the reinsurers.
So interestingly, the strong suit about P2P insurance, as we just described it, is the social control. If I have a group of friends, it will be quite a good way to control speeding up with the car, preventing them from doing so. So the social control element is quite strong, which, however, you lose with the network effect gone if you grow to 50 people, for instance, or 100. So I think that model has its limitations traditionally, and there are certain ways to overcome that or try to be overcoming that.
Okay, so let's look at that one, because I mentioned it in the opening, and it's obviously been a weakness or something that needs to be designed around, which is, I'm not sure I trust anybody really, but let's say for the sake of argument, I trusted my family. On a good day, I trust some of them. And we all sort of insure our bicycles or something like that. That's kind of one thing. But if I just join some random pool of people in the country, in the whole of the world, insuring their bicycles, as I said in the introduction, insurance companies make it difficult. The contracts are complex. On the one hand, that's not so good. But on the other hand, a lot of their customers try and rip them off and lie and stuff like that. And that's not good either. So what are the ways of addressing this challenge?
So I think it's quite important to look at the underlying mechanics of either traditional insurance or indeed the peer-to-peer model, the first bucket, the insurance bucket, so to speak. An insurer traditionally benefits less if they pay out more. Or the other way around, the less they pay out in claims, the more sticks as profits.
So the interest of a traditional insurer is to minimize claims.
That is what you would see on the outset from coming from a corporate world. Now, having many conversations with insurers, they, of course, say we are bound and forced by terms and conditions. We have to pay out. And I would argue, yes, you have to, but you don't want to. And I think that is the big friction point in insurance, whether it's in traditional or indeed in this first bucket of the peer-to-peer model.
Yes, and they are very experienced using the detail. I mean, a practical example is Bridget and I were off to Oman at Christmas, and I barely recovered from the flu, and she thought she was going down with the flu one day before we were flying. So our insurer, which I won't mention, but it's HSBC, and they said late in the afternoon, we're flying the next morning. She spent an hour and a half trying to get through to the bastards, to even get through to them. And then they say, oh, well, according to your terms and conditions, you know, you will need a medical sign-off. Well, this is like, you know, the evening of the night before. How are you going to get a medical sign-off? Oh, well, yes, we understand. If you're not well, then obviously you'll have to get one next week. So hang on. So you're taking a bit of a risk, taking a massive gamble. We could have just cancelled the trip, but then we would have to go and find some doctor to say, well, actually, you're not well, you know. So the terms and conditions is something which large organisations can, if they're not very good doing their job, can hide behind. There's this saying that the law is weak on the strong and strong on the weak.
It's an interesting phenomenon because hiding behind the fine print has led insurance to where we are today. There's an article in the Telegraph a couple of years ago, the skier cover that fails to cover skiers because of an obscure footnote. And of course, then the cost for making up the PR mess was a multiple of the actual cost to cover the skiers. So I feel like we need a shift in insurance in general. It's a great good, a good for society. I deeply believe that. However, how it's carried out is just not the right way any longer. Customers want to feel protected. And if they pay for an intangible good for service down the line, they need to make sure that there is something waiting for them, hassle-free, that warrants the payment for several years, if not longer.
Okay, now you've got me very worried, because as we're recording this, I'm off skiing in 3 days, and when I bought my lift pass online for the Trois Vallées, it said, oh, do you want this sort of ski insurance? So I ticked some little box and it didn't cost very much money. But of course, like anybody else, I didn't read through the massive terms and conditions, and even if I did, I probably need a lawyer. So, okay, so we're agreed that that's a problem with the existing marketplace, but I'm still unclear around the P2P about what approaches would practically work. Let's take the skiing case. There are lots of people going skiing to the Alps. It's been great snow this year. In a world, let's fast forward 10 years, you know, you've been incredibly successful and actually you dominate the ski insurance market for people from the UK. And I get to the little box and do you want Lacker's P2P or half P2P or whatever it is, insurance? And I go, oh yes. So how do you solve the practical problems?
So now we're mixing up two things, the current
P2P
model.
I always mix up two things. Normally I mix up more than two things.
Give me a chance to clarify.
Oh, I don't do that either, actually.
The current P2P model, how they are incentivized is, the storyline is very much, in current insurance, insurers make money if they don't pay out. Bold statement. In P2P insurance, the offerers or the providers take a cut of the premium regardless if they pay out or not. So take £100 in premium, I'll take my 20 quid, and I have neither an interest to reject or approve your claim. I'm well off in either case.
You're like a fund manager,
so to speak. So that is then also, it's a starting point, a change for the better. But now what Lacker is about is proposing to take it one step further. We propose to make it a success fee. We make only money when we settle claims. We add a fee on top of the claims we settle before we split the bill across people. So let me give you a concrete example. Our first use case is cover for high-value bicycles for theft, damage, and loss. So we don't charge premiums upfront any longer. We onboard customers, like-minded customers, I should say, through our web-based app. They join us. If someone has a claim, we pay out. At the end of the month, we add up all bills, add our fee on top, and then split it across the people in the pool. It's almost like, coming back to analogy earlier, we are all in the pub, I'm your waiter, I serve out drinks all night, get the tab, add my service charge, and split it across everyone who was in the room drinking.
But in the pub, if people turn up, they don't order drinks, you don't charge them a service charge.
So we split the service charge and the cost of claims across everyone who is happens to be in the room.
I'm getting confused. So if there are no claims in June, let's say 24 of my friends insure their bicycle with you, and nobody has a claim in June,
yeah,
they don't pay anything and you don't make any money.
That is absolutely true.
So you're incentivized to steal their bicycle?
Yes.
Okay.
No, we are not. Because for me, it's a long-term play, right? So if there are no claims in June, there will be in July. So I will look after a period of 12 months. I don't care if they come in January or in July or in December. Specifically, cycling is a cyclical product.
Cyclical product? Is that a joke? Very good pun.
So in actually, we launched only recently. We launched in January our first product after sorting out regulatory requirements and finding a partner last year. In Jan and Feb of this year, our customers didn't have a claim. So we sent out a bill to them with a black zero. You had full cover, but you didn't have claims as a group, so the bill is zero. That will not stay always like that, and especially in summer when people are more out riding, there will be a charge. However, and we believe that will be significantly cheaper than the market rate because we play on the customer's behavior. That means if everyone takes better care, they will pay less. So when you come to our website, we give you a personal quote, a cap, which is called a stop loss in insurance terms, we purchase from our partner Zurich. And that is basically the worst price you will ever have to pay with us insuring your bike. Now, that price is also at around market rate. So our promise is you won't pay more than with competitors, but if you all take better care, you will benefit on the upside. And it could be, in fact, zero.
Okay, so that's very clear. And there's a lot of stuff in there too. Unpack, starting with just some simple financial exposures. If you're not taking my premiums up front, you're running a credit risk on me, because maybe June is really bad for claims and I don't pay you money. And let's say there's 1,000 of me's in this bicycle thing. You've then got to go to the small claims court and chase 1,000 people for £50 each or something. So how are you addressing that risk?
That is our main business risk, absolutely. We believe in the current world, the customers at the short end of the stick. So insurers are quite comfortable taking your premiums up front for a year often, and then they sit on the money, generate investment income, and when you have a claim, you're being interrogated almost. So we say we need to turn this around, pay out first, and then collect the funds later on. That puts the customer on a pedestal, and I incur a credit risk, as you pointed out.
So presumably you have to do some Experian or something like credit thing. If I'm some bankrupt, you're not going to insure me because you don't believe that me in prison being bankrupt with no money is going to actually pay you.
So now we are playing again on the behavioral topic. So our first use case, high-value bicycles, is a real passion. So someone with a 4-5K bike would rather default on the mortgage payment than on the bike-related spending. So that's our hypothesis. We do monthly renewals, monthly billing, so we don't have credit risk accumulating over a course of a year. So it's really short tail risk. And then we pre-authorize credit cards to make sure that they are valid so we can take the 20 quid a month and need to prove that credit risk can be managed better than underwriting risk and to the benefit of consumers.
Okay, so that's a very good answer, which is, as often in financial services, you can't make risks go away. You can just kind of like, it's like squeezing a balloon. If you squeeze it in some area, it's going to expand in another. So in a few years' time, you will say, ah, it's interesting you say that, Mike, and our experience has been that 98.4% of the time we get the money, and 1.6% we don't, and that 1.6% is covered by this, that, and the other. So that's the credit risk that you have on your customers. In terms of financial flows, you're not making investment income because the money's coming later, but you've got a lower cost base. So coming back to the use case of bicycles and the behavioural part of it, would you just like to unpick a little bit more how you incentivize me not to make claims again?
Yeah, so we are forming a risk pool of like-minded risks, high-value bicycles. So all the nutters and going out on a Sunday morning for a ride.
I keep running into them in the sort of the North Downs because there's loads of them. Ever since the Olympics, it's a nightmare.
So there's a very strong informal bond already. And we are playing on the fact that you are part of a community of people like yourself. So if you inflate your claims or defraud the community, so to speak, then you are harming yourself. At the end, you are fronting the bill. So what we are trying to introduce is accountability. At the moment, you pay your insurer a premium and you get whatever service out of it. In our case, we tell you, you pay based on your collective behavior. And what really struck me was, we went to a cycling fair, which we sponsored, and spoke to one person and asked him, how do you feel about sharing cost of claims with fellow cyclists at the end of the month? And he said, I should pay for other people's claims. I don't want that. He was not aware that insurance is about neutralizing risk, that there's a risk pool, however it's cut. For him, it was a black box. He throws in money and when he has a chance to get something out of them, ideally more than he's owed, he will do so. In Germany, it's called sports for the masses to trick your insurer. And I think we need to overcome that sentiment to introduce accountability again, telling people you pay for based on what you behave. Now, that's the naive part of the view of the world. Of course, if you have a lot of people behaving good, there will be one person playing on that saying, if everyone takes good care, I don't have to. And with that, we are going to have a risk tiering where we have the conscientious people in one pot and the new joiners in a separate one. And you will have to tell me why you deserve to be in a conscientious risk pool, so to speak. And that goes very easy by staying claims free for 6 months, by watching a video, how to lock your bike ride, for instance, gamifying the experience a bit.
Okay, so that's, again, very interesting. And you've got a lot of material in there. And the point which is well made, which is that none of us, when we're buying insurance for all the things that we do get insured, escape the fact that our costs are completely related to the claims experience of the industry. Let's say we all insure our cars, and let's say next year a huge number of cars are stolen, then our premiums will go up. It's less transparently obvious in the insurance market as is at the moment because there's all these complicating factors. There's capacity, supply and demand of car insurance. There's the investment returns, yada, yada, yada. But you make a very good point that there's no way that one can avoid it. The other thing that I'm taking away from what you're saying, and this is perhaps why our mutual friend was recommending you guys, is that what you're doing, as far as I can see, is taking a step back from insurance, almost moving your 3D view 90 degrees around and slicing and dicing the same risks that exist in the marketplace at the moment into a different pricing and a different behavioral model.
So we still needed to find a way to make this work in the existing environment. So to give you a sense where we are coming from, we made a point to the regulator that we are consumer finance because we charge in arrears, we have negative cash flow, so to speak. We are, in fact, a consumer finance company, not insurance.
Oh, excellent. How did that go down with the regulators?
As you would think, no, we had good engagement, not least because of the FCA sandbox. However, after a lot of back and forth, the verdict was, it looks like insurance, it has to be insurance. And we went the way of the least friction. Instead of debating further, we moved on and made it work to get the customer
learning. Just pressing pause now, because I'm interested in this point, which is that when you've got regulations, the regulations will have one chapter saying, this is the chapter for squares, and the next chapter will be, this is the chapter for triangles. To me, it would seem to me that you are both a consumer finance operation and an insurer is the actual answer. You're a consumer finance operation in that if you're insuring my bike today, you basically lend me effectively the money for a month. You're pre-funding it. So you're definitely ticking that box, but you're also ticking it because you're an insurer. But presumably from a regulatory perspective, they didn't want to come up with the answer that you're both, because you have to be an A or a B.
Our sandbox application read almost as follows. When you have a claim, you can apply for a loan, basically, which you have to repay in parts. So it was a very interesting challenge to put this in the right words. London is a very developed and enrooted insurance / financial services market. So I do see the point that you cannot rewrite the rules entirely. However, it's hard to press innovation in a certain bucket if it doesn't fit in.
Exactly. And John Siegel was on the show about 2 or 3 years ago talking about this very point. Of course, 2010, 2011, those days, there wasn't regulation around fintechs, which was one of the big advantages. And at a certain point, regulation with a capital R comes in, and regulation has to say it's a square, it's a triangle, it's a circle, at which point any innovation that happens after that phenomenon has to be squeezed through or into one of those shapes. So if you've got a subsequent innovation in the marketplace, which is a hexagon, which is a bit like what you're doing, you then go along and you explain at great length how you're a hexagon. You've got six sides, they're all the same shape and the same angle, and they listen and they nod their head and say they agree. And then they say, oh, you're a square or a circle.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two answers to that. The one way we could have gone would be going the unregulated way, become a membership club of some sorts, no legal reinforcement if someone decides not to pay. But we deliberately wanted to earn consumers' trust by saying, here's a stamp. The FCA, after all, looks after protecting the customer, so it's almost a sign of quality. So we want to go that way, and then we had to adopt our business model in the back and collect the right data points to make an even stronger point why we should be consumer finance in the future.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway, just in passing, it's an important point that codification is the antithesis of creation, in a way, is the antithesis of innovation. I'm not sure I'm a great fan of what gets passed as art these days, but the great thing about a blank sheet of paper is the only parameters are the edge of the paper. And you can do whatever you like. So we're in the West End at the moment, and you can produce all sorts of things on that piece of paper without limit. Once you start saying that either it's a black and white, or it's a photo, or it's a painting, and da-da-da-da-da, you've, by definition, limited the amount of possibilities that can be created. Anyway, it's interesting that folks like you who are still trying to innovate and trying to press this point home. But just kind of like wrapping up this thing, coming back to what I see as the core, and has always been the core challenge of this, which is, as you say, the behavioural science around a group of people. As far as I can see, the human being has always been and still is a very tribal animal. So people will tend to act in one way in terms of loyalty and honesty in their small family unit, in the larger clan, in their tribe, and maybe in their country. But the further you go in these kind of, as it were, range of circles, the less loyalty that exists. I might be very loyal to fellow cyclists in my family. I might be quite loyal to cyclists in my cycling group, but I'm probably not that loyal to cyclists in Peru. I don't really feel any identification. So coming back to making peer-to-peer model work, it seems to me that when you've got circumstances where a group is tightly connected, a bit like a molecule, there are strong bonds between the atoms, then I can see this makes sense. When you've got a group which is loosely connected or not connected at all, like individual hydrogen atoms just floating around, then it's likely not to work. So along that spectrum, at a certain point in time, let's say you find a use case for P2P that works, P2P insurance. At some point in time, your model breaks down before you insure every risk in the world for every 7 billion people. And how do you, as a person creating and running this business, how do you find that point where, this is the subset where it works?
Yeah, so in the current peer-to-peer model, people gather around a product, a common interest, which is your phone, your car, and whatnot else. We come from an angle that plays on emotional high-value assets, like bikes, for instance. So we don't want to say, find your group of friends, but rather come from an affinity angle. You all like cycling. You are totally mad about cycling. That's a strong and formal bond to start with. That's on the widest end of the funnel, so to speak. Now we need to find even further denominators, for instance, splitting up the mountain bikers from the road bikers, for instance, and the e-bikes. And within these groups, we can then subsegment again, telling them you are the new joiner, and here's another one like you who rides 100 miles a month, for instance, or 500 miles, or has been claims free for 6 months. So we can tell people you're grouped accurately with people like yourself, with the same risk profile, and not like in home contents insurance, for instance, throwing in a bike, a washing machine, and a phone.
So you're creating a segmented tribe of very similar people in the first place, where there's going to be, as it were, more connection between the group than a diffuse bunch of people insuring washing machines and bicycles and everything.
That's the starting point on the onboarding. And then, of course, we want to play on the claims piece as well. It is powerful to connect people, to make them aware that you are part of this group and your friends are too. So imagine a message when you put in your claim of £1,000, absolutely valid. And we say, thanks for putting that in. The group will pay that, including Mike, Stephen, and Tom, who are your friends. So those are the small trigger points we want to play on to reduce and manage control and fraud.
And in terms of you rating the individuals and you changing their premium, let's say you've got a very good system that's running. Let's say I join tomorrow, and let's say I'm a sort of fraudulent claimer and I'm always putting in claims to you. How do you change my premium, and how do you stop me screwing up your nice system of honest people?
In the insurance world, there's a term, a bad risk.
It's definitely me, yeah.
I challenge, what is a bad risk? Because you might be a good risk, but unfortunately have a claim on the second day. Does it make you a bad person or a bad risk? What we want to do is having a new joiner pool if you are claims free for a certain amount of time, or actively engage, which you don't have to, but engaging means for me, watching a video, how to lock your bike ride. That makes you a better risk profile and you should be grouped accordingly. So there are certain subjective and objective parts in the equation we can influence. We need to move away from a world that currently exists where you are priced based on the postcode. You could live in a very bad area, but if it's your most favorite possession, you will take extra care instead of someone living in a good area never locking the bike, for instance. So it's finding the right trigger points and playing on that.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it does sound like you're inventing something that's radically slicing and dicing the world from a different perspective. And as always, it's not really a question of, is this a good idea or is it a bad idea? A bit like the risk. It's a question of the parameterization. You know, if you charge me 99% as premium, then that'll be a good deal for you because I don't claim 100% of the time and you make money. So it is quite true in finance that it's not so much the bad risk, it's the question of the wrong price for a certain risk. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there, especially you cyclists, and my brand partners of the podcast. Blue Motor Finance combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500 million of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Okay, so just in terms of wrapping up, Toby, we've mentioned lacquer in passing. We've mentioned the fact you like bicycles and all that kind of stuff. In terms of an unconstrained throwing of the breadcrumbs upon the waters for all the fishes out there, what things would you like people to get to know and to buy in, and why should they check you out other than if they got bicycles?
So to start with, of course, all the cyclists among the listeners, please do check us out. We appreciate every single policy on our way to prove that our model is worthwhile doing. We are looking to roll out additional products in summer who are high value, emotional, community oriented. We have a few ideas in mind. If any of the listeners wants to bring forward an idea, we are always happy to listen to that. And do stay in touch. There is more to come from Laka. And thanks for having me today.
And in terms of channels to market, Jimmy from Urban Jungle was on a couple of shows ago, and I was talking to him about the fact that, as I see it, insurtechs are facing with a challenge about how to grow the business. And most of the young insurtechs I meet are kind of doing two avenues at the same time, which is reaching out directly via the interweb to customers, blah, 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 but also just providing a sort of kind of white label channel for partners who may have superior distribution, and you guys are doing the sort of the product and the engineering under the bonnet, as it were. So are you seeking just to get your own customers one by one via your own marketing, or are you going to be doing the sort of the white labeling, or are you doing both potentially?
So the one question that wasn't asked, why cycling to begin with? And I think that answers your question in part. We do cycling because we can really immerse ourselves in the ecosystem. It has outgrown golf as the biggest recreational sport now in the UK. And in cycling, you can immerse yourself well, in cycling clubs with the partnerships, point of sale, point of service, but also a thriving ecosystem on Facebook, on social media, so multiple attachment points. So you are, the answer to your question is both. We are looking for partnerships. Any ideas, any links there, please do reach out to us. And we actively advertise on social media. So in a community-oriented product, it is great to get referrals, to get people talking about yourself. We have a customer who very kindly wrote a nice blog post about us to get the word out. We're dependent on all of these things. And over time, clearly, every B2C startup is fighting for attention and distribution. And we will have to prove over time that we are able to get the people to the door.
Yes, I actually read the blog post of the chap you mentioned, the cyclist, whose name, of course, I completely forget. But I think, as you mentioned, email, you couldn't have written it better if you wrote it yourself. And it was a very good example where if you do a good product, then some people, out of the kindness of their heart, will take their time to appreciate it. And it's a little bit like podcasting in the way it's a tiny percentage of very kind people who will just spend 5 minutes going to iTunes, which is the one that people tend to look at, even if they're not Apple people, and writing a kind review of the London FinTech podcast. So for all you listeners out there who've done that, thank you very much. I never actually get fake reviews out there, which is known in the industry, but it's the same kind of thing. And it actually only takes one of those to really motivate other people in the direction of going towards people who are trying to do something good and positive for the world, as you are. And that chap that wrote the one about the bikes was a very good example of proof of concept from the ultimate, which is the consumer, which is the person who's bought it, appreciating you. So I think it's going to be a very interesting journey for you going forward, Toby. It's the more radical you try and do things, the more challenges you set yourself. So I think you're going to need all your martial arts fitness to keep you going and doing 50 press-ups in the morning. And I wish you every success in the future.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.